The Moon Belongs to Everyone by Michael Alexander and K.C. Ball. A quote from President Richard M. Nixon, State of the Union Address, January 11, 1962. Mankind has always ventured into the unknown. We take risks, accept surprises, and adapt to new experiences. Such quests are worthwhile in and of themselves. They represent one way in which we express the human spirit. This country was built on that willingness to take risks. America is a great nation, and a great nation must remain an exploring nation if it wishes to maintain its greatness. I say today that the sky is no longer the limit. I pledge that our nation will venture out into the unknown. We will take risks, accept the surprises, and eagerly await what lays beyond the bounds of our world. What we start today with my words will lead to an American walking on the surface of the moon before the end of the next decade. And before 20 years have passed, I expect to see Americans venturing to Mars. I want John Gillespie McGee's hopeful words to become America's reality. With silent, lifting mind, I have trod the untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand to touch the face of God. November 26, 1979. I eased from the staging shack airlock just at the edge of the mammoth cylindrical melting tank. Beyond the open lip of the tank, a 40-foot-long hollow tube of ice waited, gleaming in the raw sunlight. I couldn't shake the notion it was a mammoth bullet ready to be loaded into the barrel of an enormous gun. 60 miles below Odyssey's selenocentric orbit, the moon's sterile surface looked pristine, crater walls and mountain peaks casting crisp black shadows in the harsh sunlight. I moved toward the ice. Maneuvering in a pressure suit still felt cumbersome despite 8 weeks' recent training. The resistance of the sandwiched layers of the suit, a steady flow of chilled air, the constant hiss of communications gear. All that hadn't become second nature. Not yet. But I had all the practice I could ever want ahead of me. A 12-month work contract at Rockefeller Base with an option to renew. In less than 6 hours, I'd be on the moon. All through the weeks of training, I'd looked forward to being on a different world, doing different work, beginning a new life. My past refused to let me go, though. "Laura Kerrigan," a man shouted, as I disembarked the cislunar tug at Selene Station. A big fellow arrowed toward me, swimming the station's zero-G as if he'd been born to it. He reminded me of Thomas Mitchell, the actor who played Scarlett's father in Gone with the Wind. Wide and solid, graying. Just a bit past 60, maybe. "How the hell's your old man?" he called as he drew near. I didn't know the man, but his face jarred loose memories of training document photos. I'd played job-related undercover games too long to flinch at his approach. I let him wrap his arms around me in a friendly bear hug. "I'm Tom Garver, Kerrigan," he whispered in my ear. "Call me Tom. Pretend I'm a friend of your father. Ask me for the tour I promised you." The name produced more memories. And so I called him Tom. We played our little scene, and I gave up what sleep I might have managed in the little time I'd have on Selene Station to ride pillion with Garver on an open cockpit work sled across the 5-mile gap to Odyssey. The Mars ship. "I'm construction manager," Garver said, on the low power suit-to-suit link during the ride. "I got a situation that fits your old line of work. I'd be grateful for your point of view." I heard, "You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours." It couldn't hurt to look. God knew I could use a friend in power. That was all I could ever do, though. Look. I no longer wore a badge, couldn't officially investigate anything. That bastard, Liam Childs, had seen to that. I reached the melting tank's shadow line. A thin fiberglass cable stretched into the darkness of the tank from the big eye bolt melted into the near end of the ice tube. 16 tons of reaction mass for the voyage to Mars, waiting to be melted, and another chunk of ice would be on its way up from the surface in less than 3 days. Odyssey, I'm ready. Roger. Garver's baritone mumbled in my headphones. A thin line ran from tie-off on the shack bulkhead to an anchor point halfway along the ice. Two suited figures waited for me there. One of them held a heat cutter. I focused on memorized procedure. Hook a suit safety line to the cable. Squeeze a quick burp from the maneuvering unit. Don't use your hands on the line to stop unless you have to. I slid along the line, burped the other way at what I figured to be halfway, and stopped just short of the suited figures. Just like I knew what I was doing. The glare visors hid their faces from me. "Who's in charge?" I asked. "I am." A woman's voice. She lifted her arm, showed a red supervisor's band ringing the bicep of her white EVA suit. Should have spotted that. I turned to the second figure, the suit marked by a blue band. "You the one who found it?"
"Yeah."
A man's voice. He tapped the frozen surface with a gloved finger.
"Came to rig the lines to pull the ice inside. Saw that in there."
I moved close to examine the glittering surface, wiped my glove across the ice. "That looks like a..." The woman interrupted, sounding insistent.
"It's a foreign object in the ice."
"Yeah," the man said.
"A foreign object."
He sounded as if he wanted to be somewhere else.
"How long will it take you to cut into that?" I asked.
"A few minutes, no more than 5, the woman said. "It's warmed up quite a bit."
"Do it." "I'm going back inside."
The man tugged at the safety line and pulled himself around to face me. I blocked his way.
"I want that opened. You need to..." "I don't need to do anything. This sort of stuff isn't in my contract."
The radio crackled.
"Garver here. You two want to finish out your contract and get your bonus. Do what you're told."
"No argument from me, boss," the woman said.
Nothing from the man.
"You hear me, McIlvaney?" Garver demanded.
"Copy,"
the man said at last. The woman pulled herself into position and helped the man brace the tip of the cutter against the glistening surface of the ice.
"Clear," the man called.
He keyed the unit. The resistance coil inside the thin shaft heated fast. The cutter eased into the ice. Vapor streamed off into space. With the surety of a butcher opening a carcass, the man ran the cutter in a smooth circle 2 feet in diameter. Finally, he backed away. He and the woman braced against their tethers, pushing at the disc with their booted feet. They muscled it into the cylinder. I got no argument from either one when I waved them to the side. I pulled myself into place and peered into the hole. The top of a suit helmet showed itself. Its side had been badly dented, but it remained intact. I reached through, still awkward in the suit, grabbed the locking ring, and spun the suit.
"Well?" Garver demanded.
I studied the cold, dead face within the helmet. No sign of trauma. Then I rotated the helmet away so I could examine the rest of the suited figure. A ragged gash ran along the left suit leg.
"It's not an empty suit," I said. "There's a body inside. Might be a suicide or unreported accident, but I wouldn't rule out murder."
A pause.
"Copy that," Garver said.
I had time to consider what I'd seen outside on the lonely float along the ship's central corridor. With the minimum light and the quiet, the ship felt sterile, as if it were waiting to be used. As well it should, it was brand new. We'd read all about Odyssey in orientation classes. A 2-year build. 80 men and women in orbit, 60 on the surface of the moon. 12 months of work, 3 months rotated back to Earth to rest and recover. That's what the documentation said, anyway. Construction had been completed 3 weeks ago,
3 days behind schedule. Garver and his Finnish crew were racing to catch up. Some of the orbital crew still waited on Selene Station for a berth back down to Earth. Those who remained on board were there to finish electrical tests, bring the Nerva reactors to full functionality, and handle the last of the water uploads. The schedule had no flex. The launch window for America's first manned interplanetary shot on January 1, 1980, drew near, and all Americans knew that if the ship didn't launch, the Russians would win the race to Mars. The remaining workers bunked in the staging shack, back by the melting cylinder. Garver had set up quarters in the crew dormitory on board Odyssey instead of staying at Selene Station. I wasn't sure I'd care to do that. Empty, the ship felt spooky, filled with strange echoes. It smelled funny, too, like the stink of long-used, overloaded electrical equipment. At least, I half expected that.
"First time you go through an airlock, take off your suit," an instructor had told me at the tavern down the road from the Florida training site. "You'll catch an acrid odor, the smell of ozone. We call it catching a whiff of vacuum."
He had plied me with drinks and stories most of the night, hoping for the same poke and tickle Childs had been after. Neither had succeeded. I grabbed the anchor bar mounted outside Garver's office to brace against reaction and knocked.
"Come on in," Garver called.
I pushed the door open, pulled myself inside. The room was good-sized, designed as quarters for 6 crew members. Military tidy, too, but full of Tom Garver. Books velcroed to every open surface, engineering plans and photographs taped to bulkheads. A framed photo of Garver in dress naval uniform, a full commander, hung on the bulkhead above the built-in desk. A shot of Garver and President Reagan, shaking hands, shared the wall. Scribbled notes stuck here and there. A floating 10-foot-long scale model of the ship, tethered at 4 points to a work table, took up the center of the room. Sections of the scale model had been pulled away to show compartments. 2 long cylinders in front of a shielded section containing the Nerva nuclear propulsion units, their heat exchangers looking like big ribbed wings. The ship's ancestry was evident. It had been birthed from modified upper stage sections of the Saturn V rockets, as had Selene Station. The place reeked of Captain Black tobacco. I wondered how Garver kept a pipe lit in weightlessness, not to mention how he got away with smoking in the first place. The man had to have serious clout.
"Thanks for going out there, Kerrigan," Garver said.
"If I can call you Tom, you can call me Laura."
"All right, Laura."
The construction manager straddled a saddle at the work desk. He wore his salt and pepper hair in a crew cut over a round, deeply seamed face that demanded trust. I hoped such trust would be deserved. Garver waved for me to join him before a compact television monitor.
"Come look at this," he said.
A color broadcast flickered on the screen. Garver tapped it.
"Sent a crewman with a hardwired camera out so I can tape everything while they pull the body out of the ice."
I watched over Garver's shoulder. Whoever handled the video camera knew enough to shoot with the sun. The picture almost matched broadcast quality, caught all the details.
"Good camera work," I said. "Good camera," Garver said. "A beta cam. Great for location shooting. Networks haven't seen one yet. I got 6. They're for the mission. All mine until the ship leaves."
"I don't know that one."
"State-of-the-art from Sony."
"Japanese?"
"Yeah. The little bastards turn out good product."
The camera image zoomed in on the crushed helmet. The crew finished sliding the rigid body from the cylinder, a tight fit. They weren't being particularly careful.
"We've got to get that ice melted and in tank," Garver said. "Sorry if they're screwing up your crime scene."
"My crime scene?"
"You're the only cop I've got."
I shook my head. "I went out there as a favor, Tom. Gave you my professional opinion, but I'm not a marshal anymore."
"I know. I did my research," Garver said,
taking up his pipe. You got laid off 14 months ago.
I got fired.
Childs had done a real smear job, made sure my name was deeply buried in the mud. I hadn't even been able to get a private security job at a time when companies were begging for former cops. That's why I'd taken the moon job with the LTC. They were so desperate they'd hire almost anyone.
Want to get back at Childs?
Garver's hands seemed to move on their own accord as he packed tobacco into the pipe.
How could... I know people who owe me favors, he said.
But... He waved away my words.
I always do my research. I know what he did to you. You handle this for me, you'll be back on Earth. Full benefits, your jacket cleared. If that's what you want.
I felt as if I'd been pushed off safe footing into deep water. My father was a cop. His father before him, too. Working law enforcement had been the only thing I'd ever wanted, had ever done. Having to deal with the loss of my badge, not being able to land another law enforcement job, almost killed me.
You okay? Garver asked.
Yeah. Suck it up, kid, my father used to say.
You want your job back?
Yeah. Garver nodded.
5 deaths in 2 years in orbit. All verifiable accidents. The surface rate's been higher, but that's mining for you.
He tapped the screen with his pipe stem.
But this was no accident, and the notion of murder pisses me off no end. I want to catch whoever did it. Even more, I want to get my hands on whoever thinks he can mess with my schedule.
Has there been other sabotage?
Garver frowned. 4 times, I'm sure of. Others, maybe. I don't run the show down there, so I don't see all the paperwork. There's been money lost, project downtime, and injuries. Never murder, though.
Could it have been the Russians? I asked.
Nah. The military types on Selene Station watch the Reds pretty close. Besides, they're way too busy with their own Mars ship down in low Earth orbit.
He glanced at me.
You see it?
I knew what he wanted to hear.
Ugliest thing I ever saw.
Garver nodded.
It's different design philosophy. Brute force, but proven tech. They don't have nuclear thermal engines, so it's LOX hydrogen for the trip out. Hypergolics for the ride home, dump everything and land in a couple of Soyuz capsules.
He paused to try to light the pipe. The match went out before it caught.
Why did we go with nuclear engines? I asked.
Garver shrugged.
Hell if I know. I'm not that kind of engineer. The way I hear it, nukes increase specific impulse so you use less fuel.
He struck another match without success.
And building the ship here in low lunar orbit cuts even more reaction mass compared to LEO, he said. No cryogenics means simpler tankage, and so on. Mining metals and water on the moon's cheaper than 50, 60 Saturn launches to LEO. It's all supposed to save time and money.
How's that worked out so far? I asked.
Garver grinned. Who can say? Will American free enterprise beat the godless communists? Not my department. My job's to make sure this crate's in shape to leave orbit New Year's Day.
He paused and drew a breath.
What were we talking about?
The miners, I said.
Yeah. Old story. Work conditions suck, they don't get paid enough, don't get to go home enough. They want a union.
I remembered growing up in eastern Kentucky coal country, watching my friends' fathers come home from work, too tired to scrub the blackness from their skin before they fell into bed. Seeing retired miners, old men before their time, slumped on dilapidated porches next to green bottles of oxygen. Appalachian astronauts.
Will they get a union?
Garver fiddled with his pipe, not looking at me.
Someday, he said. We can't afford one now.
I didn't say a word. He spread his hands.
Laura, I sympathize with them. My old man was shop steward for his ship fitters local at the Philly Navy Yard during the big war. He built the ships, and I was a swabby sailing on one of them.
This time, he looked me in the eye.
Pop could sing the Internationale as well as Debs, but he knew there was a war to be won. Just like now, except the war's cold. I hate having to act like a company asshole, but I've got a fast ship to build and I'm sending it in harm's way. I've got to know if there's more trouble coming at me from the moon.
What do you want me to do? I asked.
Go down there. Poke around and stir the pot. Find out who's screwing with me. I don't care what you have to do, just fix it. I've got 36 days until launch.
Garver glanced at his wristwatch.
Speaking of time, let's get you back. Drops 3 hours and 27 minutes. A scheduled truckload. 6 engines, you and a guy named Anderson. I expect you know him from training classes. They're expecting you. Know you used to be a cop, but they know you've been through training, too.
Understood. He studied me for a moment.
Schedule's tight, but I can give you a little time to think it over.
I shook my head. I don't need to think about it, Tom. I'm in.
Garver grinned. I like a woman who knows her mind.
So let's get going, I said. He rubbed at his crew cut.
Just one thing.
Go on. I don't bite.
Garver shook his head. I don't believe that for a second.
I raised my hand, palm out and fingers up. You don't have to worry about me. He shook his head.
Look, I'm old school. My pop taught me to take care of women years ago before ERA became the law.
I said I'd be all right.
Don't get your Irish up, he said. Just be careful.
I laid my hand on his shoulder.
You sound like my old man. It's sweet. Make fun of an old man all you like, but I mean it. I've read your jacket, Laura. Know what you've done. I'll bet you're hell on wheels. But so was Leatherman, the other cop I sent.
He glanced at the monitor. The camera remained focused on the stove-in helmet. I tipped my chin toward the image. That was Leatherman?
Yeah.
He struck another match and sucked on his pipe. It wouldn't catch. He tossed it at the desk, where it bounced back. He grabbed it without looking.
I don't know why I bother with that thing. Keeping it lit in zero G's a bitch.
I checked my harness one more time. The soles of my feet tingled. My stomach fluttered. Getting ready to take a no-frills ride. Another suited figure stood opposite me, focusing on the harness, too. Around us, 6 recovered ascent engines had been strapped to the open platform of the landing truck, flaring expansion nozzles almost touching. No pressurized cabin, no flight couches. No one who'd done the drop before to hold our hands and tell us not to worry. America's Lunar Technologies Consortium didn't spend a dollar when a penny was enough. I know Armstrong and Aldrin landed standing up, too. They had walls, though, but LTC had studies that said walls were unnecessary mass. Someone with a nasty sense of humor had named the truck, marked it in big, red letters sprayed on its side. Thumper. I closed my eyes and tried to think of other things. The ride up to Earth orbit came to mind. 6 men and women crammed into a stripped Apollo capsule like stacked bodies in a morgue, going into space in a claustrophobic can. In low Earth orbit, we had transferred to the cislunar tug for another 2 days to lunar orbit. As I waited, I wondered if I'd signed up on the wrong side once again. When I did Academy, it all looked black and white. You were either a good guy or a bad guy. These days, it seemed the only thing I'd ever done, all those years as a cop, was keep the folks who didn't have a dime from taking one from those that did.
Gotta pay the bills, kid, my father used to say.
Maybe so, but I wasn't sure anymore if I cared for the cost. I checked the telltale on my oxygen. Like the truck, the suits were simplified. No sophisticated adsorption canisters. No complex rebreathing circuit, just a 6-hour tank of air. 4 now.
Thumper, Selene Station here.
Below, the lunar landscape slid by. I let the other rider respond. A 30-ish fellow, Anderson. He'd proven during training he loved the sound of his own voice.
Go ahead, Selene.
Anderson again.
You all ready for the deorbit burn?
Damned straight.
I answered in the affirmative as well.
Copy 4, Thumper. Go for DOB, ignition 30 seconds.
I closed my fingers around one of the grab bars welded to the engine cowling and counted to myself. The truck's engine fired when I reached 1,031. Not bad. My feet pressed against the grated floor. I set my jaw to keep my teeth from chattering in time to the vibrations. I felt the roar of the engine in my bones. My stomach fluttered again at the return of gravity. I counted down on the 30-second burn. The engine cut off on the mark.
Thumper, Selene, burn nominal. Power descent initiates in 57 minutes at 230 nautical miles from Rockefeller Base.
Copy, Selene. Anderson again.
I took in the view. We had just under another hour of standing ahead of us, watching the moon roll beneath as we fell toward the surface in a long, computer-planned arc following the Terminator around the moon. At the end, the truck would make its final powered descent into the darkness of the polar crater that sheltered America's Rockefeller base. I should be scared. I knew that. I stood on an open, free-falling platform 60 miles up, loaded with heavy equipment. The LTC preventable accident record sucked vacuum, too. It didn't matter. I had gotten used to the view by now, and I loved amusement parks, the roller coasters and rail slides, the free-fall drops. I figured to enjoy every second on the greatest thrill ride any engineer had ever imagined. I was facing in our direction of motion. As we came over the South Pole, I was watching the approaching horizon over the edge of the platform as the Earth rose. Bright, half full, distant, stunningly beautiful. I hummed the opening notes of Thus Spake Zarathustra.
What's that?
Anderson asked over the suit link. I didn't bother to explain.
Music from a movie, I said.
An hour later, and 50,000 feet above the surface, 230 miles uprange from target, the engine flared to life again, slowing us. At 10,000 feet, the landscape below barely crawling by, the truck pitched over to a near-vertical attitude. I saw our destination, a crater filled with darkness. At 3,000 feet, I caught sight of the lights outlining the bullseye layout of the buried habitat. At 700 feet, I spotted scattered equipment and the base's junk pile in the lessening shadow near the eastern rim wall. Suited figures moved about, here and there. A rover rolled toward the rim. Landing beacons flashed a rhythmic red west of the habitat. All so familiar, so ingrained in my memory from training films and countless photographs, it seemed as if I had come home. But it felt as if we were coming in too fast. My hands itched for a steering wheel, the old passenger's dilemma. There wasn't any. Either the computer did the job or it didn't. If it didn't, Anderson and I, the ascent engines too, would become part of one more shattered monument to mankind's reach for the planets. The engines would be missed the most. In the end, the truck slowed, hovered for a moment, and sank to the lunar surface without incident, just as it had many times before. The engine shut down. Two suited figures skipped to the truck, began to check the cargo. They ignored us.
This is Rockefeller Base.
A woman's voice. As opposed to, say, Detroit?
We hear you, Anderson said.
You two can come on inside anytime you like, the woman said. I'll meet you at the door.
I unhooked my harness, released the straps that held my duffel and the small equipment case Garver had provided me. I slid between the bells of two engines and stepped to the ladder. Anderson arrived first. He began his climb down without even a glance at me. He paused at the last rung.
"Watch this last step, Kerrigan," he said. "It's a Lulu."
He dropped his duffel, let go the ladder, and fell slowly the last few feet to the surface.
"Asshole," I whispered.
I forgot the common band was always on. Anderson scooped up his duffel, turned away from the truck. And as he skip-stepped toward the habitat, he showed a gloved middle finger over his shoulder. I hiked to the habitat, almost catching up with Anderson, taking care with the low-gravity gait they taught us in training. A skip-step that had looked strange in demonstration in the films we'd seen. It worked well enough in practice. Weight isn't mass, they endlessly reminded us in training. Take your time. The loose regolith in this area had been sucked up long ago as aggregate for the sulfur concrete used to build the habitat, so I didn't kick up any dust and left no footprints as I moved toward the rounded gray mounds that were the dormitories and common spaces of the base. Poured tubes half buried in the floor of the crater. No windows, no exterior lights, except 24-inch tall green neon script letters that blinked out West Entrance above a rectangle of light. It was a nice touch. Further to the west, I spotted the adit to one of the rim wall mines, marked by a red neon arrow pointing down. Someone had painted, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," in man-high red letters on the wall above the arrow. As I closed on the entry lock, I passed collections of skeletal equipment. High chain-link fences, topped by razor wire with access through a locked gate, surrounded some of them. Pharmaceutical plants. The fences kept the riffraff out. As we reached the habitat, the broad glass door beneath the sign swung open and a suited figure stepped out. The left leg and the right arm of the suit had been painted in an intricate, colorful pattern. A swirling band of red, blue, and green crossed the torso at an angle, intertwining flowers, just like a complex tattoo inked upon a naked body. Within the blossoms, I made out a name. Zender.
"Welcome to the moon, folks."
The same woman who had called them at the truck.
"I'm Posey Zender, LTC personnel liaison. You can call me Posey. Wipe your feet before you come inside."
I returned the greeting. Anderson waved and moved inside. Beyond the door, the airlock was a revolving drum, not too different from a darkroom safe door, except with gasketed edges, and made of plate glass, like the front door to some New York City office building. Anderson was already inside, moving like a man looking for the can.
"This lock made me nervous when I first got here," Posey said. "But it's safe. Cheaper and easier than a pressure lock. Foolproof, too, with fewer complex parts. Cuts down on repair time overhead. LTC figured if you have all the oxygen you need, conservation isn't a necessity. It just takes a long, hard push."
I kept my mouth shut and marked the door as a place not to spend much time near. It might be fool-resistant, but I'd seen too often that nothing ever was completely foolproof. Beyond the lock, Anderson headed for a glass door to the habitats. He'd hung his plain white suit in one of the 25 glass-faced lockers that filled the 10-feet-wide habitat section. About half the lockers contained vacuum suits. Most of them had been painted in some fashion. Not all were as colorful as Posey's suit, but each carried some sort of statement from its owner. A full-body skeleton, the alien from that Sigourney Weaver movie a couple years back. Flags of all sorts. Daffy Duck chased by Marvin the Martian. "What's with the suits?" I asked.
"It's called freedom of expression," Posey said. "Everybody gets free rein to paint their suit any way they like. There's always a couple extras at each lock."
"I'm not an artist."
"Someone will help if you want. Any ideas?"
"I'll think of something."
"Whatever. Find a locker, stash your suit," Posey said. "This is only temporary. I'll get you a locker closer to your work assignment once you're settled in."
I found a vacant locker,
focused on removing my suit and wiping off its surfaces. Posey did the same. She turned out to be rail thin, a 40-something, horse-faced woman with close-cut, russet hair. She wore a green jumpsuit with a name patch over her heart. Out of the suit, the tube felt chilly. It had a grungy look to it, too. Not overly dirty, but edge-worn, as if someone had been working on it with a dull file. Sounds bouncing from the concrete walls. The expanded metal floor had a hollow echo. The lights burned dimmer than in the trainer, half not even working. A glass door closed off the tube at the far end. A second airlock would have been nice. A scrolling, lighted sign above the door showed time and date. 1320, 26 November, 1979. Posey headed toward the door.
Come on, let's get you settled in. You go to work tomorrow.
Do I get OJT? She laughed.
Yeah, sure.
November 29th, 1979. The dark closed in as I stepped out of the airlock onto the surface of the moon. Sunlight caught the tips of rim wall peaks 3,000 feet above me, but didn't touch the crater floor. The only real illumination where I stood came from a scatter of lights on the assembly line and my helmet lamps. Edie Dupree, my shift partner, waited. She had worked with me patiently for the past 3 days, showing me the ropes. First day, I asked about days off. Dupree smirked and shook her head.
Read your contract, she said. 12 hours on and 12 off, 7 days a week.
With Dupree's help, I learned to set up an ascent engine assembly while getting used to working on the lunar surface, to inspect a recycled RL-10 engine and attach it to the circular support structure, to test the pump tanks and fittings. I felt confident I was ready to move on. Dupree agreed.
You got your moon legs, Kerrigan. Let's build an icicle.
She waved me on. I moved with her, the low-gravity gait now familiar.
Remember, think through every move, Dupree said for the 100th time. If you don't know, don't pretend you do. You can kill yourself if you have to, but for God's sake, don't take me with you.
Got it, I said. Measure twice and cut once.
Right. Training's over. We gotta catch up for those 3 days. Odyssey burns at midnight on New Year's Eve, and we've gotta finish filling her reaction mass tanks before she leaves.
Why midnight?
She looked at me as if I were a child.
The bad thing about leaving from low moon orbit is that Delta V change in orbital planes creates a narrow window of opportunity. But it doesn't have to be midnight. That's pure showbiz. They have to go at midnight because the president says they do. The people say they do. Corporate PR says they do. Paper puts up with anything.
Ahead were four large cylindrical tanks, two of them 3 times taller than the other two. Ladders ran up opposite sides of each tank.
Over them, a stringer crane ran on a track to the launch area. The engine assembly we had worked on last shift waited in a cradle there.
Casting tanks, Dupree said, pointing to remind me.
The short ones for the LOX, tall ones for the liquid hydrogen. They poured one yesterday after our shift, and they're almost finished cooling. The two at the end are complete. They pulled the cope, froze the caps last shift. Time to build the stack.
This whole thing seems a bit nutty.
Yeah, but it works. Since we have to lift the water to orbit anyway, why not save on raw materials and make the water the fuel tanks?
It's 50 degrees absolute down here in the shadow. That ice is rock hard. We shoot it up to Odyssey where they melt it into the reaction tanks. Then they bring the engine assembly back down for another run.
I looked around.
Where are the winch controls?
Dupree held up her gauntlets.
Right here.
The motor they sent up cracked a bearing from the cold first month. The second one lasted 60 days. They've been promising a redesigned one for 18 months. Until they send one up, we use muscle.
They didn't mention that in training.
Lots of things they didn't mention, trust me, trust you? Maybe someday. Dupree grabbed the chain dangling from the gang pulley and dragged the winch over to a short tank. I skipped to the tank. Dupree gestured toward a ladder. Up you go. I hopped up the rungs. As I came over the top, I saw the circular disc of ice that would become the top of the tank, looking like a raw glass casting for a big telescope mirror. Heads up, Dupree said. I grabbed the descending ring and guided it over the ice. Let me know when it's about 4 inches below the upper edge. I could hear the effort in Dupree's voice. Down, 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 stop, I said. I saw the chain swing, slap lightly against the tank, and I expected to hear a clang. None came. Stay alert. No oral cues. Dupree's helmet appeared over the opposite side. Good job, good job. Ice looks good. You steady the ring while I lock it. I leaned forward, stretched my arms to each side, trying to get the ring at as even a height as possible. I felt it snug up. Hands clear, Dupree said, grunting. The ring settled into place. Sure it won't slip and break? I asked. Oh, ice. Remember, that ice is 50 degrees above absolute zero. It's granite. Copy that, I said. Let's get this baby out of the cradle. We both climbed back down. I was surprised at how much effort something as simple as climbing a ladder at 1/6 G took. Something one of the Florida trainers had said popped into my head. Half your work will be against the suit itself. Take your time. The biggest danger is overheating, even if it's cold outside. The universe as thermos bottle. Does the ice ever get stuck? I asked. Once in a while. There's heating coils in the tank wall just in case. Most of the time, it's no problem. Let's give this a try. We both pulled on the chain. The compound pulley above us rotated smoothly. The ice expands when the water freezes, Dupree said. The tank's designed for that. It contracts some as it chills down, enough to give you windage. Three more pulls. I looked up to see the ice peeking over the tank rim. Looking good? I asked. Looking sweet. We continued pulling, a bit at a time, until the ice cylinder cleared the tank. Okay, let's slide this down to the engine mount. We took a step away and pulled. The winch resisted for a moment, then slid a few feet, ice dangling below. There's a clutch fitting that won't let it run free. Not that you should trust it, Dupree said. Last thing you want is for that sucker to take off on its own. Remember, weight isn't mass. How you doing? Five by, I said. Actually having fun. That's what the Virgin said. By this time, I'm a hooker. I grinned. In it for the money, huh? A pause. No, I see it as my own small contribution to mankind's leap for the stars. Of course I'm in it for the money. It's my job. Besides, I'm not going anywhere. I remembered we were on an open circuit and made no reply. We slowly walked the ice down the 100 yards to the engine cradle, with not much more effort than pulling a child's wagon. Okay, Dupree said. When we're done, that hunk's got to be centered, true, and flat. Let's take our time. Copy that. We moved the cylinder slowly over the flat circle of ice on top of the engine platform. Okay, Dupree said. I'm going to lower, you guide. Take your time. Get it right. Remember, that thing masses a lot more than it weighs. The placement went uneventfully. I guided with one hand, the way I had steered sections of concrete sewer pipe 2 summers on a job during college. We're good. Let it down. Dupree lowered it the last quarter inch, walked over to inspect. Good. I just gotta go up top to check if it's level. Sometimes the casting can be off a bit. Can I try? I felt Dupree give me the once-over from behind her visor. Finally, she pulled a bubble level out of a suit leg pocket and handed it over. I'll hoist you up. Take cross measurements in the middle and at three points along the edge. Gotta be within a degree of vertical. The bubble's ethane shouldn't freeze if you're quick about it. Dupree hopped down past the cradle, grabbed a chain hanging from another pulley. Dragging it over, she handed a hook to me. "Hold on tight," she said, and began hauling me up. A minute later, I cleared the top of the ice cylinder, let go of the chain, and stepped onto the surface. "Okay," I said. "Let's try this." Bouncing to my knees, I put the level on the ice and studied the bubble. Less than half a degree. I inched sideways, crosswise, dead center. As I crawled toward the edge, something hit me in the back. It wasn't much, a tap, but I wasn't expecting it. I fell forward. My chest hit the edge as I slid off the top, helmet down, toward the ground 20 feet below. I opened my eyes and tried to sit up. "What the f—" Dupree pushed me back onto the cot. "You're inside, safe." The old line, "must be a definition of the word safe I'm not familiar with," popped into my head. "What happened?" I asked. "Near as I can tell, when you let go of the chain, you must have given it a push. It came around and caught you in the back." "I must have hit my head in the fall. It knocked me out." "First fall up here's scary. Maybe you fainted." Dupree offered a glass of something. I accepted it, took a sip. It tasted like strawberry Kool-Aid. "The damn fall seemed to last forever." Dupree's lips quirked. "Under 3 seconds, but no worse than falling 4 feet back on Earth. Gives you a jolt, but it won't kill you. Just don't try it from the top of a 50-foot hydrogen tank. That will kill you." Was it an accident? Did you try to kill me, Dupree? Or try to scare me? I took another sip, collecting my thoughts. I wasn't sure if I had pushed the hook and chain away or not. Either way, I'd have to watch my step with even more care from now on. "Just so you know," I said, "I don't faint from fear." I swirled the liquid in the glass. "This stuff's terrible. Got anything to dilute it with?" "No alcohol allowed on the base." I looked at her. "And you call yourself a miner?" Dupree grinned. She walked to a desk and opened a drawer, pulled out a plastic container and another glass. "Got a vacuum still out behind the Ruzic cryostats," she said. I held out my tumbler. Dupree cut the red liquid with the same amount of clear, then poured herself an equal dose. We touched glasses and drank. It was a surprise. "I know it's an old line," I said, "but this is smooth hooch. Real grade A moonshine, and I know my shine." I polished off the drink in 2 gulps. Dupree grinned. "If we ever get decent shipping costs, we could sell this stuff for good money, Earthside. Beats Stoli hollow." She collected my empty tumbler. "Regs say you rest for the rest of shift." "And let everyone think I'm a wuss and incompetent?" I pushed up onto my elbows. "Get the medic to look at my pupils and let's get back to work." "I'm all you get, so we go by regs. There's no medic, not since the last one did walkabout 3 months ago. Never did find her, and they haven't shipped in a new one yet. Posey says it's problematic finding tech staff. I figure the real reason is the company's too cheap to pay for one, this close to launch." "Posey does seem harried, doesn't she?" Dupree looked at her glass. She held the bottle out to me. I shook my head. "Posey is like one of those thought experiments I read about in high school. A perfect, frictionless, rolling bitch." She knocked back the drink. Later, I lay in my bunk, staring at the ceiling and sorting things out. Item. Nobody would talk about Leatherman. Item. There was no evidence that what happened was anything but an accident. Item. It was remarkably easy to have an accident down here. Posey could have done him in, or arranged it, if she had something to hide in her handling of the project and thought Leatherman was sniffing too hard. Her moonshadow, cold exterior might be cover for a deep insecurity. Or she might just be frozen to the core. Dupree could have done it. She was hands down the best roustabout on the surface. Everyone I asked said so. Setting up an accident would be easy for her. The question was motive. For that matter, any of a half dozen miners could have done it. Bumping shoulders was easy here. The almost total lack of privacy, the grinding schedule, the seeming indifference of the corporation to legitimate complaints. I'd arrested more than one man who had murdered because I didn't like the way he looked at me. When the moon was waiting to kill you just because you were here, nerves could get raw fast. I had insufficient data. I had a long list of suspects with plenty of means, plenty of opportunity, even if motives were unclear. Shift change in 4 hours. The people I was getting to know would be all over me, razzing me for all they were worth. Secretly glad it hadn't been them who'd taken the fall. December 3rd, 1979. Sit-down meals were served every 6 hours. I wandered into the dining room just after the purely arbitrary 12 noon GMT chimed over the public address system. An hour until my shift began. I paused at the door, sniffed, and wrinkled my nose. I knew that smell. Chipped beef. At the hot table, I picked up a plate and spooned what looked like a lumpy wheat paste onto toast. At least there was salad. I'd asked Dupree where the fresh greens came from. "Little bootleg greenhouse next to the still," she said. "I'll show you when we get the chance." Last time, the still had been in a side tunnel of the biggest mine. It seemed to move around. I added instant mashed potatoes that looked like they'd been scavenged from old stores in a fallout shelter. There were empty chairs at a corner table with a fellow I had met a few days before. He looked up as I approached. "Hey." I cocked my head. "You mind, Jake?" He gestured acceptance. "Help yourself." I sat down. "You ready to go home yet, Kerrigan?" he asked. "You can call me Laura, Jake." "You do what you like. I'll stick with Kerrigan. It's less personal." He turned his head to cough. "Excuse me." I heard home in Kadar's voice. Eastern Kentucky, or maybe just over the Tug River in West Virginia. I took a mouthful of chipped beef. It tasted the way it looked. "Jake, you're an old hand here. You've been up, what, 2 years now?"
23 months, 9 days, and...
He looked at the clock on the wall.
4 hours.
He coughed again.
"Excuse me again.
You had a doctor listen to that?" He shrugged.
"Last medic told me I had sinus problems just before she went walkabout. I figure I got moon lung. The damn dust's everywhere. Funny thing. I came up here to get away from the dust in the coal mines back home."
Another thing they hadn't talked about in training. "Can't the company do anything about it?" I asked.
"They could. They've talked electrostatic precipitators for years. That's all they do, talk."
"How long you sign up for?" I chewed, swallowed, decided maybe it was time to lose a couple of pounds. "Year, option for 2?
"It'll be 2, trust me. There's never enough return berths, and the military up on Selene get priority. I've been on the wait list so long the ink's almost evaporated."
He swallowed a mouthful of mashed potatoes and pushed his tray away.
"You know, you sound like Leatherman," he said.
"Who's Leatherman?" I asked.
"Who was Leatherman, you mean?" Kadar said. "Short-termer. Asked a lot of questions, just like you."
"What happened to him?"
"Up and disappeared 10 days ago. We all marked it off to a walkabout. Sometimes it happens early like that. Scuttle now is they found him in an ice tank up in orbit. Hell of a way to go."
Kadar coughed again.
At least he got off this rock.
I toyed with a forkful of lettuce.
Didn't anyone notice he was gone? I mean, there's procedures. Hell, I memorized a bunch of them.
Kadar waved his fork.
Sure, there's procedures. There's schedules, too. We ain't met one of those since this operation started. Supposed to be 3 teams out working on the same rocket, round the clock. That's what the rules say. We're lucky to get 1 full team every shift.
I sat silent, hoping he'd say more. He did.
Leatherman probably slipped and fell in. It's dark out there. Whoever his partner was must have figured he went inside for something. Next shift, put the cap on. Before you know it, he's on his way to orbit.
No one looked?
No one looked because no one thought to look, Kadar said. There ain't no procedure 78, paragraph 14. Look for a body inside the tank before sealing.
Who was his partner that day? I asked.
Kadar studied me. You ask a lot of questions for someone who says she used to be a cop.
I didn't blink. A guy got killed. You know how old habits are.
Kadar leaned toward me. Look, Kerrigan, this here's a small place. But all that means you got no room and no right to stick your nose into other folks' business.
He coughed, long and hard, hacked up a dirty phlegm into his closed fist. When he found his voice, it sounded rusty.
We looked everywhere. Didn't find him. Like I said, short-termers don't go walkabout that much, but it happens. And life goes on.
I wiped up the last of my gravy with a bit of toast. How many have gone walkabout?
Ain't answering no more questions.
Kadar pushed back his chair.
You'd think that would free some return berths, I said.
Kadar laughed, a thick, angry, snorting sound. He scooped up his tray. As he shuffled away, he hummed a tune I recognized. 16 tons. December 5th, 1979. 2 days later, standing behind a berm under a makeshift roof, I watched as the countdown neared zero. It was the second launch I'd worked on, the first I'd had a chance to watch, and the first time I'd worn my painted pressure suit. I'd found an image in the base Britannica that haunted me. An ice queen. A woman's face, pale white skin glistening, icy blue eyes downcast, framed by a mass of silver hair. She wore a crown formed of ice crystal shards. Dupree helped me copy the life-size image onto the chest of my suit. We framed it in part with stark black lines.
Suits you, Dupree said when we were done.
So far, no one else had said a word. 3 floodlights illuminated the glistening icicle in its cradle. More light on anything that I'd seen since I arrived. The ice rocket stood roughly the size of an old German V-2. The larger hydrogen tank sat atop the LOX tank, both on top of the engine assembly. 3 thin spars ran up the sides with rings around the tanks, providing some additional integrity to the stack. Feed lines melted into the tanks connected them to the engine. The clever idea was to make the payload, the ice, double as the fuel tanks. No need for an expensive and time-consuming development of a metallurgical facility to make metal tanks.
Does this whole thing really work out cheaper? I asked.
Dupree made a verbal shrugging noise.
We haven't tried both ways, so I guess we'll never know, will we?
I don't worry about it. It's just a job. Under a minute. It gave America a moon colony, I said. I heard the rancor in Dupree's voice.
No, it didn't. We got a mining operation and a supply base with some corporate manufacturing. This isn't a restaurant. It's a fast food joint.
30 seconds.
And we got 26 days to serve up 112 tons of water.
Dupree continued.
7 more icicles. An LTC doesn't care squat about anything else. Neither does that prick Garver.
Everything goes well, we'll be done by Christmas, I said. The countdown hit zero.
Here we go, Dupree said.
There was no swirling water vapor around the rocket, but I saw ripples of refraction at the base as the engine caught. The rocket began to rise, slowly. Moving out of the floodlights, it became hard to see, just the barely visible flame of the burning hydrogen.
I expected it to take off faster, I said. These things are right on the edge in terms of performance envelope. It's got just enough oomph to make orbit and do the circularization burn on the other side.
The rocket was climbing faster, beginning to arc over. At 2,000 feet, it emerged into the sun, a tiny sliver of light. A second later, the sliver seemed to blossom into a snow globe of twinkling points.
God damn it, Dupree said. You jinxed that one, you and your if everything goes well.
What?
It shattered. Christ, couldn't you tell? God's pendulous nuts.
I heard a click in my headset.
Selene Station, Zender here. You in line of sight yet?
Copy, Rockefeller Base.
We just blew a load.
Say again?
Your ice delivery will shortly be scattered on the ground a few miles from here.
Garver joined the conversation.
When can you send up the next one? Schedule's getting tight.
He sounded as if he'd stay calm through the second coming. Posey took her time responding.
We'll get back to you soonest on revised schedule.
Copy. Selene Station out.
Posey's voice filled my headset.
Base meeting in the mess hall, now.
Dupree turned toward the lock.
Hope you're happy. Now you get to see Posey pissed.
What do we do now? I asked.
We forget about celebrating Christmas.
December 7th, 1979.
Kerrigan!
I looked up from the book I'd been reading. Something by John MacDonald. Posey stood in the open door of my quarters.
What? Talk. My office, now.
She turned and hurried down the corridor. I hesitated, then followed. As far as Rockefeller Base went, Posey was the corporation. Management, personnel, records, everything. She was loud, overbearing, remote, and twitchy enough to make anyone uneasy. Since we lost the icicle 2 days ago, she had gotten worse. Posey was already seated behind her desk by the time I got to her office/quarters. By moon standards, it was spacious.
Close the door, she said as I entered.
I did as I was told and took the chair opposite her. I didn't ask permission first.
What's between you and Garver?
Zender asked without any preamble. She was still wound up from the icicle loss.
What do you mean?
You stopped in on him before coming down.
I saw no point in trying to deny it.
Garver and my father go back. I stop by to pay respects.
And I'm Marie of Romania. Everybody knows you were a cop. I think you're still a cop. What does Garver have you sniffing around for?
I rubbed my forehead. The skin was getting dry and itchy from the canned air.
I was a cop, a federal marshal. Now I'm an LTC operations technician,
a tinker in a spacesuit.
Once a cop? Bullshit. Some people hang on to the past, I don't.
I tried to ship you out of here after that icicle blew up. Garver blocked it.
Like I said, he's a friend of my old man. They go way back to the Navy during the war. Posey leaned forward.
Look, I know something and you know something, but you don't know everything.
What's that supposed to mean?
I know what they found in that icicle that we delivered just before you came down.
Scuttlebutt says it was a body. She stared at me for a time, then sighed and gestured over her shoulder at a hand-drawn Gantt chart on the wall.
All right, play it that way. The right side of that chart is 1 January, Kerrigan. 2 January doesn't exist. Got it?
Works for me.
Posey's eyes flicked from side to side. She looked over my shoulder.
Look,
I'm sorry if I came down hard just now. I'm under the gun here. I kept my face neutral.
I know that.
She nodded and leaned back in her chair.
The corporation promises me 6 drills, I get 3. They promise 4 loaders, I get 2. I have to melt that water before I can pour it. That takes power, a lot of power. And I have to crack some of that water for fuel and breathing air. That takes more power.
Posey was on a rant.
I held on for the ride.
They promised me 5 SNAP reactors, I got 3. They promised a megawatt of solar arrays. I got 200 kilowatts and I didn't want them.
A reactor's easier, more reliable. But some senator's got a friend who makes photovoltaics. That's why half the lights are never turned on.
She drew a ragged breath, close to the edge.
They promised a crew of 60. I can barely hold on to 30.
They projected a launch failure rate of 3%. It turns out to be more like 10%. I'm running low on engine assemblies, and there's no time to get more. I have to have Odyssey fueled to go by January 1st. I have a crew on the edge of mutiny. I'm accused of sabotage.
I interrupted.
You?
I'm in charge. I get the crap thrown in my face. Garver would just love to have a scapegoat to hang a failure on now, wouldn't he?
Why would he do that?
Posey paused to cough.
Listen, good Kerrigan. A place like this, you don't keep secrets long. You snoop around anymore, I'll find out.
I don't trust you, so don't get in my way.
Or what?
She stared at me, maybe realizing she'd said too much.
She waved her hand in dismissal.
Get back to work.
I walked out and closed the door.
Posey had been on the moon since the base was completed, 3 years plus. She coughed a lot, almost as much as Jake Kadar. It was a wonder she hadn't gone walkabout.
December 15th, 1979.
Fireworks?
I stood outside the habitat, out of sight of others. I had the small transmitter Garver had given me jacked into my suit comm plug. It worked on a frequency only Garver would receive. When I spotted the point of light that was Selene Station rise in the south, I called him. The signal was weak, but clear.
They're being loaded on the truck now, he said. Be down in 4 hours with a support technician.
Whose brilliant idea was this?
A certain 15-term congressional bacterium, Garver said. The representative thought it would be wonderful to celebrate the new year and Odyssey's departure with a fireworks festival on the moon.
If I could have slapped my forehead, I would have.
Do the corporate big shots think it'll be visible from Earth? Will it even work?
They'll work. Oxidizer is self-contained. The plan's to set them off just as Odyssey breaks orbit and to televise it from Selene Station. A royal send-off.
Garver paused, continued.
Keep your eyes open, Laura.
And my suit closed.
Anything new?
Posey's calmed down, but some of the others are getting nervous. Dupree asked me yesterday why I keep walking off behind the habitat.
And?
I told her I like to take a leak in private.
A static growl.
Keep an eye on her. The other newbie, too. I haven't been able to find out much about Mr. Anderson, and when I don't know something, it bothers me.
I saw an ellipse of light on the ground in front of the airlock and drew back a bit.
Tom, someone just came out, probably Dupree. We're scheduled to do the final checkout on the icicle before they tank it up.
Anything on her?
Garver asked.
You know, she seems all right. But they said that about Ted Bundy, didn't they? He seemed like such a nice guy.
The station was moving across the sky.
Laura, I know I told you to get to the bottom of the Leatherman thing, but first priority is Odyssey. Check that. It's the only thing. The rest of that water has to get up here, period.
We'll get it done, Straw Boss. There are some real beefs down here, but most of the crew know the score.
You sound almost happy. Getting moonstruck?
The place grows on you. You know, like athlete's foot.
December 18th, 1979.
There are advantages to being in a small place, having good hearing, and going through police training. I was in the small galley adjacent to the mess hall on my turn at KP, scrapping dishes and loading them in the industrial dishwasher. All the comforts of home. The mess room was empty, save for two men sipping coffee at a corner table. Anderson and Kadar. Sound didn't carry well in the habitat's low pressure, and they spoke in near whispers. But as I said, there are advantages. I heard most of what they said.
Timing's everything. A statement, when you brace, before ship is overhead. A dummy, only one shot. Go off with a, for maximum effect, make sure. Yeah, boxes marked.
I heard chairs slide, then footsteps.
Later, Anderson said,
and they were gone. One shot, maximum effect. Box is marked. Time to take a walk in the dark. I suited up for my next shift 2 hours early and turned through the north lock, out on the surface nearest the supply dump for those materials that could stand the cold and vacuum. Where are the fireworks? If you wanted to smuggle up some sort of explosives, where better than in a shipment of explosives? I skip-walked the 100 yards to the dump, regretting the need for my helmet lamp. Once there, I faced 500 square feet of identical shipping containers with no discernible order. I flicked off the lamp before I turned around, looking for any signs of movement or light behind me. Nothing. So I turned back to the scattered crates, flicking on the lamp, and stood in the limp-armed stance I'd learned to minimize effort as I began to examine the nearest crates. Paranoid me. 30 seconds later, I cut the lamp, turned to see if anyone was there. Still nothing, so I returned to my study of the crates. A minute later, some sixth sense made me turn again, just in time to be hit hard in the shoulder. If I hadn't turned, it would have been my helmet. I took 2 staggering steps back and fell, landing on my hip. I raised my arms and hit the chin switch that turned my headlamp to full intensity. A suited figure loomed over me, some sort of bar grasped in a raised gauntlet. What to do? Lying on my back in the suit, I wasn't even sure I could stand up unassisted. The figure swung the bar down in a full arc. Block it. I let it land, taking the blow on one arm. Grab the bar. I grabbed the bar with my free hand. I pulled as hard as I could, rising a few inches as my attacker lost footing and toppled onto me. My breath was coming hard and fast. I could feel the rush of adrenaline pushing me to act. I kept my grip on the bar and shoved my attacker up and to the side. Roll over. I pulled the bar free and jabbed it down, levering myself onto my chest. One deep breath and I pushed down as hard as I could, rose to a precarious angle and almost fell back again before I got the bar in place, using it like a cane. The figure on the ground struggled to stand up. Whoever it was, they donned an unmarked suit, so I had no idea who had attacked me. See how the bastard deals with a cracked faceplate. I heard a thin whistling and suddenly felt cold and lightheaded. I raised my arm and saw the cracked gauntlet ring, vapor streaming out. Damn it, get inside. I reached down, increased my oxygen flow to maximum, and turned, skip-walking as fast as I could to the airlock. My attacker would have to wait. Staying alive came first. December 19th, 1979. I blamed the suit failure on embrittlement from the cold. No one questioned me. Metal can react strangely at those low temperatures. Only my attacker and I knew the truth, unless someone had given orders to the attacker. I tried to ignore that thought. I was getting as paranoid as Posey. The bright point rose above the horizon. Tom?
Here, Laura, talk to me.
Right. No questions until I'm finished. I stood behind a boulder slightly taller than I was, with my back to a wall of rock. Nobody would sneak up on me again. I laid out the events of the previous day quickly. The fireworks were in the pressurized storeroom. I chatted up the tech. Turns out it wouldn't be too good to keep them cold and in vacuum for very long.
So?
So this morning I snuck in to give the stuff a quick look over.
And?
I know a bit about weapons, and I don't know zip about fireworks. Most of the stuff looks like stubby mortars. There's racks of them. Some singles, what I guess are leveling gadgets.
Maybe there's nothing there, Garver said.
No. Nothing screams wrong that I can tell, but there's something here. Whatever it is, I figure there was time to hide it somewhere else.
Anything more?
Anderson and Kadar volunteered to assist the technician in the setup. Posey announced she's having an emergency bubble put up so the crew can watch from the surface. That was news to most of us. A bubble?
I heard about it, Garver said. Another brilliant idea from the corporate PR people. Show miners walking around in shirt sleeves on the surface. Arthur Clark and all that. The future.
Right. Maybe helmet off, but no one here is stupid enough to actually shuck their suit and trust a plastic bag.
Careful, Laura. You're going native.
I ignored him. How high will fireworks go on the moon?
Why do you... Oh, I see where you're headed. I'll find out.
Okay. Anything new on Posey? I asked.
Just what I told you. She volunteered for the moon. Before this, her career path was flat. She's got a hefty bonus coming once we launch.
I suspect that you do, too. Garver didn't answer right away.
You're right, I do. But then you've got a lot riding on it, too.